Our guest tonight, Philip Carlo, lectures at police departments around the world, including Scotland Yard, the NYPD Police Academy, Interpol as well. We'll be back with him in a moment with his new book called Predators and Prayers, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Your latest book, Philip, Predators and Prayers, is fiction, of course, based on fact, no doubt.
Yeah, George. It's what I call faction. It's a fusion of facts and fiction. Basically, I started looking into this problem, that being the infiltration of why the church was so filled with molesters. What was going on? How was this happening? As I mentioned earlier, I wrote a book in the mid-80s called Stolen Flower, which was my first published book, which is about abducted children who were being used in child pornography. I wasn't a victim. I was never sexually abused. I did have a girlfriend who was prostituted as a child, and she kind of relived it numerous times with me, and I realized it was something that was very hard on her.
Sure.
It definitely affected her as an adult. She had a twin sister who also had been prostituted. The twin committed suicide. My girlfriend found her corpse after 2 weeks. So she was not the same person anymore after that. And I was thinking I would kind of write her story. And I started approaching that, and I didn't really quite know enough. And she and I ended up breaking up with one another. I moved to Europe, and I kept hearing that children were being sold, that child pornography was legal, that you could buy children, that things like this. And I went all over the place. I was in Amsterdam, I was in Naples, a brothel for children in Naples, and I saw and learned an awful lot that was going on, the truth about what was really happening. Mind you, this is about 1983. I wrote this book, it came out, and it opened the Pandora's box. I had no idea there was really an epidemic of child abuse going on. I never meant to become a spokesperson or a child advocate or anything else. I just saw a dramatic story that I felt needed telling, and I told it, and suddenly I was all over the place doing talk shows and media, and meeting more and more victims and learning more, and started meeting people in law enforcement, being invited to a symposium on child sexual abuse around the world. Thus, I went to Scotland Yard. I lectured them, the Manchester Police, Interpol. Mind you, I'm not patting myself on the back, and I'm really hoping it doesn't sound
no,
like
it
that.
Does not.
I'm just trying to say that I was out there, and these series of things happened. And I became more and more aware as a result of seeing and knowing in a very hands-on way.
Well, these predators, Philip, these scumbag predators, who they are, they tend to, why is it, like, for example, in the last couple months, they have been released from jail, they don't register, and all of a sudden they end up picking up a child, and they've killed them. And
this is the question. And I, if I may,
I don't think they can be cured.
Basically, what I found out was the truth, and the truth is this: these individuals, these sexual predators, are highly motivated, highly driven. Their sunrise and their sunset is one thing: the molestation of children. They don't want anything else. They seek out employment that brings them into contact with children. We know that for a fact. Boy Scouts, masters, school bus drivers, janitors in schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Always when these individuals are caught, and they're very hard to catch, by the way, and they go to jail, when they get out, in jail, by the way, there is no therapy as such, and sexual predators cannot be cured. You cannot cure a rapist. That's the truth. There are social do-gooders that try to say that they can be cured, that they can be helped. It's a bunch of baloney. What we need to do, what we have to do, is always err on the side of the child. These individuals, once they rape a child, they have to be treated like the piranha they are. Yes, we would like to see them back in society as fruitful members of society, but until that day comes that we know that they're not going to harm children, they have to be, they really, really have to be in, under lock and key. If when they do their time, they get out of jail, which is what's happening, most recently we have Joseph Edward Duncan in Idaho. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
Well, this is the individual, as an example, of a sexual predator just released from jail. This is the guy that killed the three adults and took the two children.
Okay, okay. All right. I know the case, not the name.
Okay. For your listeners' benefit, this is an individual that was a chronic sexual predator of children. Mind you, we're talking about children, prepubescent children. He did some time in jail. He got out, and what he learned in jail, unfortunately, what they all learn in jail, is to kill the victim, to not leave somebody behind that can tell what was done to them. I'm not saying this to be dramatic. I'm saying this because it's the truth. All jail is a college on refining and being better at what the crime is. This individual saw a child. He wanted a 10-year-old girl. She had a 9-year-old brother. He stalked the house for 3 days. Again, for your listeners' benefit, he attacked the three adults. He killed two males, and he killed one was a football player. He killed the mother. He took the two children, repeatedly raped them over a period of days. He murdered the 9-year-old boy after repeatedly sodomizing him, and he terrorized that child, repeatedly raped her, and he felt so confident and so sure that he had her brainwashed, he took her into restaurants. Now, this is the whole point. Thank God the media did not give up on this. It was the media that was the hero here.
Why?
They
Tell
kept
me why.
Showing that little girl's photograph. They made sure it was the lead-off story. Law enforcement did what they could, but you know, there's only so much law enforcement could do. It's the media, it's people that write books, it's people that make movies that have to get involved in exposing the truth about what's going on. Getting back to this particular case, a waitress, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, he walked into a luncheonette, a waitress spotted the child, recognized the child, and seeing her photo on the media, the police were summoned and he was arrested.
And the kid wasn't trying to get away or anything like that?
He had a brainwash. Yeah, that's the whole
point. Is it that easy to brainwash a child that fast?
Well, children are exceedingly malleable. God knows.
Maybe she was petrified. I don't know.
God only knows what he did to her, how he tortured her, how he... And she sat there like a meek lamb.
Could have killed her brother in front of her. Who knows what?
He did. No, not... He did. She told the authorities he molested the brother in front of her. He killed the brother in front of her. And to think of a child experiencing that, he turned her into a robot. Now, God only knows what she's going to end up like without... This child needs a lot of therapy and a lot of love. She needs one-on-one therapy. She needs group therapy. She needs to be with age contemporaries who went through, no one went through what she went through, but went through molestation situations, so she gets to understand that it's not only her that this happened to. In any event, the point was this, you used the word, and it was a very appropriate word, this scumbag should have had an ankle bracelet. Right now, Martha Stewart is walking around with an ankle bracelet, so law enforcement knows where she is at all times.
Should have been castrated, to tell you the truth.
Well, of course, but at the very least, society should understand that these guys, when they get out of jail, they are not only still a danger, they're much more dangerous because jail makes them angry and bitter. If they go in with fangs an inch long, they come out with fangs 3 inches long.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And he had no ankle bracelet on his leg, and he should have. all sex offenders, particularly the rapists of children, when they get out of prison, they have to wear these for life. So law enforcement always knows where they are. We had a very similar case down in Florida where...
Do these things work, Philip? I mean, technologically,
oh,
they really work? Okay.
Oh, they really work. Tell me it's how, all electronic.
All right, tell me how they do work. What exactly is this bracelet?
Essentially, it's a homing device that's bolted and cannot be removed to the ankle. And they can shower with it, they can sleep with it, they become used to it. Like I said, Martha Stewart's wearing one right now, and they know where she is all the time.
Oh, she's not going to take off. She's not going to go anywhere. Why does she wear one?
Doesn't society have their priorities slightly backwards when a white-collar criminal, any white-collar criminal, has to wear an ankle bracelet, and rapists of children do not? That is an absolute...
It doesn't make any
sense.
I
don't want to say the word, but boy, do I want to say it, outrage. And this is, now, there's so many people out there, write your congressmen, write your senators, demand on the state and federal level that all sexual predators be mandated to wear these ankle bracelets until the day they die.
Now, let me ask you this, Philip. These sexual predators who go to jail, you know, I've been a proponent for years for the death penalty. You know, I think if a person takes a life in a first degree murder crime, they got to go. I've pushed it a little bit more where, I really would like to see beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond a jury here convicting this person. I want to see definitive DNA evidence in the conviction for a death penalty, because I want to rule out the possibility that we're not killing someone who really didn't commit the crime. And that's happened. Illinois had a whole handful of people.
Unbelievable.
Okay?
Yeah.
So there's that possibility. With a sexual predator, how difficult is it to prove that they indeed did this? My question is, are there people who've been convicted of being these sexual predators to kids, and maybe they didn't do it?
Of course. The system is not foolproof, and that does happen. But with the way you just said it, DNA, semen, these things are used now to prove conclusively that the individual is responsible. And most often, you must understand, your listeners must understand, that these are predators. They abuse and abuse and abuse and abuse. Recently, a raper of children was arrested. He had a diary, and he entered 3,000 different children he abused over a 30-year period.
Oh, yeah.
All these people think about is molestation of children. For them, it is food, it is oxygen, it is air. They're obsessed with that. I'm telling you, this is the truth, this is the way it is, and until we start talking about them realistically, we're never going to be able to combat them realistically.
So I guess even though we may convict some who truly are innocent, we're getting most of them, and it's probably worth it putting on these bracelets on them.
You know, it's such an interesting point you raise, and I feel my heart sinking in my chest at the thought of somebody being charged with raping a child and going to jail with that stigma. And in jail, it's a very dangerous place for child rapists. You know, it's interesting because prison essentially is the dregs of society. Prison represents all that's wrong with society. Even in a prison, a child rapist is not safe. In fact, just last year, a priest, John Gagan, his name was convicted of raping children.
That's the one in Boston?
Yep.
Yeah.
And he was beaten to death by a white supremacist. And he broke nearly every bone in his body. And I got to be honest with you, when I heard that happened, I said, right on. I mean, I know there are people out there that can get really upset by this, but I wrote the guy a letter that did it, and I told him, I understand why you did it, and I think it's commendable.
You did not. Did you really?
So. And I'm telling you, I've completely run out of patience for these people. And I bet you right now, some of them are out there listening, grinding their teeth as they're hearing me talk. And I'm saying it, I gladly say it to their face, because I know the damage they do. I know how their mind works. And that guy got what he deserved. If I may, we'll get back to this thing with predators infiltrating the church. This individual was 73 years old when he was finally convicted. He had been moved to 39 different parishes over a 35-year period.
So they knew what he was up to.
Absolutely. Not only did they know, they were aiding and abetting a child rapist. You know, this word molester, it bothers me, this word, because it doesn't quite tell the truth about what they're doing. They're not molesting. They're raping. They're raping their bodies. They're raping their innocence. They're raping often their souls. Now,
hiding under the cloak of God, you know?
Well, you know, if I may, I'll tell you exactly what happened. In the early 90s, I started hearing about predators.
By the way, I want you to explain, because you're Italian, right, Carlo? You're Catholic.
I am.
I'm Catholic.
I have nothing against the church. I have nothing against people who believe in Jesus Christ, just the opposite. I believe that is the wonderful thing, or whatever God you want to believe in, that's your right, and that's the wonderful thing about this country. You can pursue your spiritual beliefs any way you want. If you want to pray to the butt of a goat, you can. It's your business. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. What happened essentially, if I may, in the 50s and 60s. Pedophiles, these individuals that I've been talking about, these highly motivated sexual predators.
Now, this is the true portion you're telling me. This is not
this
the
is
fictional
the true,
part.
In the 90s, I started hearing about these predators. I started doing research. I spoke to victims that had been abused by priests. I wrote a play in 1993 that we did here in New York called Swear on God, You Won't Tell. I entitled it that because I was hearing from victims that priests were saying to them before the molestation, swear on God, you won't tell. In other words, they were using the specter of God, the specter of hell, to a little child to make them, to keep them silent. I meant to write a book about this phenomenon. I started doing more research. I ended up getting involved in the Night Stalker book, thinking it would take me a year. It ended up taking me 3 years.
All right, let me ask you one quick question first,
please.
Philip. Were these people, these individuals, pedophiles first, or did that happen later?
Well, basically, they were. These are not good priests gone bad because of celibacy, like some people want us to believe. These are child rapists who became priests because they knew the church would protect and coddle them.
So they were already bad.
Well, like I said earlier, pedophiles seek out employment that will bring them in contact with children. Becoming a priest brought them in direct contact with truly trusting children because they were dressed as a member of a holy order. They were dressed as an extension of God. This individual represented God. He's got this outfit on. He's got a crucifix around his neck.
So this push to go into the church was merely a mockery to protect their pedophilia.
Absolutely. It began in the mid-50s. If you look at the guys that are being arrested now for doing this, they're all in their 70s. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
That tells us that they graduated seminaries in the 50s and 60s.
True.
The guy we were just talking about, George, his name was John Gagin, that was beaten to death. He graduated St. John's Seminary in California in 1960. Paul Shanley was convicted in February. For your listeners' benefits, this was a predator.
And they're about 20-ish? They're about 20-ish when they graduate?
Well, yeah, that's the whole point. Shanley was 23 when he graduated. He graduated the same seminary that John Gagin did in 1960, the same year. He was convicted in February for raping a 7-year-old boy. He too had been moved to over 40 parishes over a 35-year period. Interestingly, Cardinal, I say sarcastically, Bernard Law graduated St. John's Seminary in 1956. A lot of the individuals, and once word went out to the pedophile community that you can become a priest and you have children, you'll be fed and given clothing, a roof over your head, and you have the respectability of the church behind you, they joined the church.
All right, let's pick up on that when we come back, Philip. I also want to ask you if this was a worldwide situation or if that just happened here in the United States. We'll be back in a moment. This is incredible. We'll be back. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Philip Carlo about what we've been talking about. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie, Philip Carlo, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast. Philip, let's pick up this story, because this is incredible, for sure. Back in the 50s and 60s, and you're saying that throughout the United States, or is this a worldwide problem?
Well, it essentially happened in the church in the United States.
All right.
Because it was there that they discovered that they would have... they would be protected and coddled by the church. What I was starting to say before, as these individuals graduated the seminaries in the 50s and 60s, they became bishops and they became cardinals. They moved up the church hierarchy. And as such, they became the people that made the decisions. And their decision was always to consistently to protect the child rapist and to never, ever do anything to help the children. Their decision was to constantly move these molesters from one parish to another and never give warning to the new parish that you had a molester amongst you. They were responsible for... The church itself acknowledges 5,200 molesters in their ranks, and if they acknowledge that number, it's got to be doubled. And to think of all those individuals to be part of a religious order, and what they're really after is raping children, is, I think, one of the darkest stains on modern society.
Oh, absolutely. Now, some of these predators, though, are married, are they not? So let's, you know, though some of them may be priests, for example, how many are just out in society in a general way, Philip?
Well, you know, we're talking now about pedophiles infiltrating the church, and they're not married. They're homosexual. Most of them are seeking little boys. Yes, in fact, not only that, what you said was about molesters being married, but not only that, often they're...
Let me post this, though. They're pedophiles first, homosexuals second, because I don't want everybody to hear this program and think every person who practices... homosexual sex is a pedophile.
No, most certainly, and I'm certainly not. If I gave that impression, I'm terribly sorry.
No, you didn't. I just wanted.
What
I'm
saying is that these, for the large part, about 90% of the sexual predators who became priests were homosexual. That's just the stats. There were individuals that molested both boys and girls. There were individuals that molested just girls. But for the most part, over 90%, they were all after little boys, and that was their victim. That's what they seeked, and that's what they were after. To answer your question about pedophiles being married, I know of many instances where we did a study in Appalachia where both the spouses, both the male and the female, were sexually abusing their children, and that it became multi-generational, that they were not only abusing their own children but their grandchildren and using them in pornography. Unfortunately, the largest aspect of child molestation is incest. What I've been talking about is isolated incidences compared to how incest is so rampant in not only this country but around the world. I was at a symposium in Denmark, and in the Scandinavian countries, it's almost the norm for adults to have sex with their children.
Oh,
and
God.
It leaves the children terribly, terribly scarred. Alcoholism is rampant in those countries. The suicide rate is very high in those countries. But nobody ever acknowledges the fact that incest is so rampant in those countries. And I do. I connect the two, in fact.
So with these people infiltrating the church, and that's basically what they've done, and the church covering up for them, why didn't they boot them out? Why didn't they just say, you're going to the police, we're going to the police, we're getting you convicted, you're out of here? Why didn't they do
that? Great question, George. Thank you for asking it. And this is the answer. They were them. they were the molesters. In other words, the insane took over the asylum. If these individuals are graduating seminaries in the 50s and 60s, and we see all the guys that are getting arrested are in their 70s, we know that they went through the system. And this system, the Catholic Church, aided and abetted, protected and helped molesters molest children. And not only that, Bernard Law, I believe, is a pedophile. If he walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it's usually a duck. This guy was responsible for protecting over 50 child rapists. He was the guy that, by the way, that was responsible for moving John Gagan all over the place and Paul Shanley. I don't know if you've seen it, but I sent a letter to the station that was written by Bernard Law to Paul Shanley in 1996 that I got through my contacts. And in this letter, Cardinal Bernard Law praises Paul Shanley to high heaven. In one paragraph, he says 9 times that he did a great job for the church, dedicating him for his wonderful work on behalf of God. And what the person he was praising was a dedicated pedophile. This guy, Paul Shanley, during Sunday sermons, talked about the virtues of NAMBLA, North American Man-Boy Love Association. You've heard of NAMBLA, yes?
Sure have. Okay. Disgusting organization.
He had the audacity to actually talk about them in a glowing way. It got so that parishioners were getting up during his sermons and walking out. He, by the way, was a member of NAMBLA.
I want to tell you one thing real fast, Philip, but just so you understand where I come from on this subject. I had a guest on this program a year and a half, 2 years ago, who talked about the psychedelic mushrooms. And it was an interesting interview. I found out after he had been murdered, he died, I found out that he was a convicted pedophile.
Uh-huh.
Convicted. And I was going to play this tribute show to him, honoring his death.
Uh-huh.
And after I found that out, canceled the program, didn't want anything to do with it. Now,
right.
Every once in a while, we play some older type bumper music along with some of the current stuff. And one of my engineers told me about one of the songs that we would play, that person was a convicted pedophile. He was in jail. We don't play that song anymore.
Right.
I mean, and that's our stand, that stuff like that.
Great. These guys are lepers. These individuals are the bottom of the barrel. These individuals are responsible for so many of society's ills and so many problems that children have that it's really, in fact, a crying shame.
All these kids that have been molested, all of them are eventually going to have some severe problems, deeply rooted problems, and God knows what they may end up doing to society when they start to fight back.
It's so interesting you say God knows, because how could any God, I often wondered as I was working on this, researching this book and writing it, allow so many children to be abused within the confines of the church? You just made such a good point. The raping of the children by pedophiles dressed as priests often took place inside the church, in the rectories, in confessionals. We know that. All that came out during Boston. And what I was saying before about Cardinal Bernard Law being responsible for so many molesters to be protected, and then when it got so bad in Boston in 2001, thousands of people were protesting his residence. They were ready to tar and feather the guy. And the Pope, in his wisdom, the Vatican, brought him to the Vatican. And they put him in charge of the church inside Vatican City. When the Pope recently died, they let this cretin say a mass, one of the 8 masses that customarily said when the Pope passes on. And people who were victims went there. There were about 400 of them. I was there that day. We protested the fact that they were letting this guy say a mass. This man, who was singly the most responsible for more molesters, never getting in any trouble.
That was their answer. All right,
They had the audacity to let this guy say a mass for the Pope. That's the kind of arrogance that they showed.
So he's there now? He's in the Vatican now?
Not only is he in the Vatican, but he's in charge of the church within the Vatican. He's thumbing his nose at all the people who he's responsible for.
This is amazing.
I need to emphasize that in a 60-year period, not in one time did the church ever report any of these molesters. All they always did was move them to another parish.
Or silently buy people off.
Exactly. Very good point. And that's what, exactly what they were doing. We know now for a fact that the church has paid out to date over $1 billion, $87 million in Boston, recently $105 million in Orange County, California. And now soon Mahoney in L.A., who, by the way, is running neck to neck with Bernard Law in terms of aiding and abetting these child rapists, they're going to make even a bigger settlement there. But prior to these huge amounts that were paid, the church was, in different parishes all over the country, was paying off parents, was giving the parents money and assuring the parents, good God-fearing people, that the molester would be get counsel, that he would be taken care of. And they never got counsel. All they ever got was they got rubber stamped by some psychiatrist who was a puppet for the church, and they put him in another parish, and they continued to molest.
So what,
Paul
what
Stanley,
is...
the individual I was talking about before, he ultimately ended up, towards the end of his reign of terror, in a hospital, a Catholic hospital for children. And he was sexually molesting children that
My
had cancer.
Gosh.
Absolutely, this is a fact. Absolutely,
kids with cancer.
This is how bad this is. Before,
are they schooling it now, Philip, or are they just schooling it now, or the church, or what are they doing about all this?
By the way, they never did anything in terms of background checks of these individuals, and still they're not. What they're doing now is a big smoke screen. All they're doing is what they have to do. Their heart is not in the right place. I just told you they brought Bernard. The Vatican brought Bernard. Bernard Law, the chief molester, controller of molesters. You know that Macbeth, the bubble, toil and trouble. Well, he was the one that was stirring the cauldron, and the cauldron was filled with molesters. That was their answer, to put him in charge of the church in Vatican City. It's an absolute disgrace. I was telling you before that I wrote this book as a novel, and I wrote it as a novel because I wanted to tell the whole story, everything that I learned, all the little dirty nuances, cracks and crannies. And there was no one case or a series of cases that I felt would clearly delineate all the dirty truths I found out. So I wrote this as fiction. And the whole story and everything I learned and the truth behind what they did, what these cretins did, is in this book. And please, I'm not trying to sell my book. I'm not touting the book. What I'm trying to do is say that through my research, through seeing and hearing and the blood and seeing the sweat and the tears, I was motivated, and I did the only thing I could do. I wrote a book about what I saw and felt. And you want to know something? We had such a difficult time getting this book published. It was turned down by 11 different publishing houses, and finally we found a publishing house that had the courage to publish the book, and it's out now, and I have voice, and I'm so thankful to you, George, and the producers there for letting somebody like me that's got so much to say about the truth about these insidious individuals.
Well, let me ask you, fellow, are you getting the support from mainstream media on this topic?
Not really. No,
I didn't think so.
They're kind of frightened of me. And I think you guys are great, and you have so much courage, and I really, really respect that the fact that you let somebody like me on. And really, I must emphasize again, I've done it a couple of times, but I have no axe to grind. I am not a victim. I'm just a street guy that saw something really bad going on. I happen to be able to write, and I wrote a book about it.
You know what's a shame about the way they've handled this in the church? Being Catholic, I think I can fairly say this.
Yes.
There are some great priests in the Catholic Church who are not pedophiles, who truly believe in their religion, who believe in God, who want families to flourish, who are just wonderful. I know my parents, my doctor, the doctor who delivered me, his son ended up becoming a priest, and I got to know him. just a wonderful individual. He ended up dying of cancer. His name was Father McGough. I remember him. Just a wonderful guy. There are some wonderful priests there who care about people. And this has tarnished it, because I guarantee you, Philip, every time someone looks at a priest, the first thing they think of is he a molester? And that is disgusting.
George, you make a very, very good point, and thank you for putting that on the table. The truth of the matter is, what the church essentially did is they tarnished their own good name, and you can't blame anyone for this happening but them. And I must emphasize, too, though, that many, many priests, good priests, saw what was going on, felt real bad about it happening, but couldn't do anything to stop it. Their priority, unfortunately, was always to protect the church, and that's what they did. They didn't protect the children, they protected the church. And I got to be honest with you, man, you know, if you see a crime being committed and you don't say something about it, in the eyes of the law, you're equally responsible, George.
At the top of the hour, Philip, when we open up our phone lines, you're going to have an opportunity, because she just sent us a note, to talk to a woman who was approached by Ted Bundy to go out and party. So that's going to be kind of fascinating when we take phone calls with you. Is anything going to happen then to clean up this mess in the church? To me, it sounds like a good old boys network, and they're protecting each other.
Well put, George. It's exactly what it is. It's a good old boys network, and they use and abuse the system brilliantly. Unfortunately, there's a statute of limitations. This is another point I'd like to make, if I may. There's a 7-year statute of limitations for sex crimes. This has got to change. There's no statute of limitations for murders. In other words, if you rape a 5-year-old boy and you destroy parts of his body, and 7 years and one day goes by, you're able to walk away from that crime. There should be no statute of limitations for sex crimes.
I agree with that.
And again, if I may, have your wonderful the listeners write in, write their congressmen, write their senators, demand that the law be changed. This is how laws are changed. It's always a grassroots situation, George. Megan's Law came about because a child named Megan was murdered by a recently released sex offender. A law then was passed that mandates neighborhoods, people in neighborhoods will know when the sexual offender moves there. Although it's not a foolproof system, it's better than what existed. The Amber Alert system mandates that an abducted child, a card, it's posted on the traffic signs from one state to another. So a guy that just grabbed a child or a teenage girl, as is happening all the time now, it can be passed on. People driving their cars can see a white car with this license plate just took a 16-year-old. That helped. But the lawmakers did not do that on their own, George. They did it because the public demanded it. The public needs to demand no statute of limitations for rape.
And I got to tell you one thing, too, Philip, before we take the break at the top of the hour. I think a suggestion for parents, most importantly, is if they see a sign that their child is just acting strangely, the personality changes, maybe the kid becomes more of a recluse, quiet within himself, there's something wrong, isn't there?
Believe your children. I did a show the other day. A father called up crying, George. I immediately knew, and he said his son came to him and said he was being abused by a priest, and he didn't believe the boy. And now every day he looks in the mirror and he feels like banging his head against the wall. He's living with a terrible, suffocating guilt. Believe the children. Believe the children. Absolutely.
All right, stay with us. We've got an hour to go, and now it'll be your turn. We're going to open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to talk with Philip Carlo. If anybody wants to chat with him about that estimated number of 500 serial killers wandering around this country, that's something to talk with him about, too. And we'll try to connect with that person who sent us a message that she was approached once by serial killer Ted Bundy. He's dead now, thank God. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Philip Carlo, right here.